I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. This winter of 2015 has become an existential crisis. Snow and ice that shuts down the oldest subway in America is a work and a paycheck crisis, but it gets worse. It's an identity crisis for hardy New England types who've been making do with this weather for almost 400 years. Where are we going anyway in a world economy that's dangling the Summer Olympics as a seal on our stardom, but no way on our potholes and our gridlock? It's all connected and all conflicted. We love the transit lines that shaped our cowpath city, but we've let the underpinnings rot. Most of America and Congress don't really believe in public transit at all, but suddenly China is surging on a subway network that's bigger than New York's. What if the best reason to bring the 2024 Olympics to Boston is that only the Olympics can rebuild our infrastructure? The U.S. at large is drowning in symptoms of a crisis. The $8 billion in debt at the MBTA pales when you hear a budget estimate out there that it would take $3.6 trillion, that's $3,600 billion, to bring the national mark on the infrastructure report card up from a flunking D today to a B. Part of the game in this open source hour is to figure how a region like Boston might leapfrog its way to the future. The future of driverless cars that are clean, too, for smart, solar-powered cities. The former State Secretary of Transportation, James Aloisi, is going to lead us into a future fraught with possibility. Two Cracker Barrel historians, Fred Zelvucci from Politics and John Stilgo from Harvard, are going to account for just how we got into this infrastructure mess and the dangers in not getting out of it. And then Ryan Chin, who runs the City Science Initiative at MIT, is going to help us see Boston and the competition in, say, 2035, with or without the Olympics. But first, we asked commuters on the Charles MGH platform of the Red Line how we're feeling through this month of wrath.
Yeah, it's been really bad. The MBTA needs to give some people their money back, for sure.
The weather is so exceptional, I feel like, I guess my bias is to cut them a little bit of slack.
They just increased the fares, but not doing their job to improve the transportation. It's not fun.
Walking to the train is actually more of a problem than riding the train, and that's saying something.
Maybe. We need to push the government maybe more to make some changes and fund public transportation. They always tell us, you know, don't use your car, use public transportation. You have to pay for it somehow.
Raise my income taxes by 0.1 or 0.2% and just give the money to the T. Millions and millions of people use the system. Tourists rely on the system. It's very much the face of a functional Boston. And if we have any hope at hosting the Olympics, God forbid, it'll require decent public transit. It's a basic public good. We've done this for 100 years. We should continue to do it.
James Aloisi, Transportation Secretary in the Deval Patrick State House. Give us the big picture, Jim. Is the fault in the storm? Is it in the T? Is it in us?
It's in all of the above. The storm was unprecedented. The T is not resilient. And we have not prepared. We, the collective, we in the Commonwealth, ourselves, the riders, the legislators who we elect, have not prepared for this day.
Why not? Seriously.
Because we are auto-centric. We have been through most of the last century. We're in a period of transition into a technocentric society, but it's a struggle. And it's a struggle for money and scarce resources. It's a struggle for emphasis. It's a struggle for understanding the paradigm shift that's taking place in our society, where people are becoming more dependent and more interested in using a multimodal, transit-oriented mobility platform.
I wonder also if we're not being asked to assimilate some bigger breakdown in a new climate punctuated by Katrina, then Sandy, and now those hurricanes, and now Juno and Neptune. I mean, are we getting a message?
We're getting a message that a politics and a policy of disinvestment makes no sense for a city, a region, a nation that wants to be and ought to be and should be a first world environment, but in many respects, whether it's LaGuardia Airport or whether it's the MBTA in Boston, resembles something much less. And I think we need to look in the collective mirror and ask ourselves if we really are the first world, first-rate mobility nation that we fancy ourselves to be, because the answer is pretty clear. It's no.
Explain the disinvestment. And one particular point, is the country at large being fair to the cities, or is it even taking note, I'm thinking of Congress, of the new attractiveness of cities?
No, I think since the middle of the last century, cities have been shortchanged. Beginning, the sort of metaphorical beginning of this is the 1939 World's Fair, the GM Futurama exhibit, where Norman Bel Geddes set up this beautiful portrayal of what life ought to be. And that life was a suburban life with a front lawn and a garage and a dog in the back. After the war, that meant a basically repudiation of the city. The whole idea that you would sever Boston in half in the historic downtown core by the elevated central artery that was designed with 34 on and on ramps within the space of a mile and a half. Mm. That was designed so people could get in and get out as quickly as possible. It wasn't designed with the idea that people wanted to live in the city. And so that example was replayed across the nation. Boston proved its resiliency because it made a very important decision in 1949, which was not to reelect James Michael Curley, but to elect John Hines and to begin a long process of renewal. But one of the things that we have suffered from and that the nation suffers from was the continuation of the emphasis being placed on an autocentric society that turned its back to cities.
We're well into an autophobic society and a lot of certainly wannabe resettlement of cities. How long does it take for investment decisions to catch up?
It takes longer than we'd like because people, there's a profit motive and people don't make investments without thinking there's a return on the other end. But you see this happening now on an accelerated basis in Kendall Square in the Seaport Innovation District where people are investing. They're investing because they're in transit-oriented districts. They're investing because they see that there's hope for a future where the people, the creative class who they're attracting as workers are going to be interested in a less of a carbon footprint when it comes to their mobility and in a more versatile mobility platform, whether it's bicycling, walking, taking the T. So the paradigm has shifted. It's happening as we speak. Mm. We're not catching up with it. And there's a lot of old think that is stubbornly holding itself in terms of the decision-making that we make every day in the Commonwealth at the local level, but primarily at the state level. And hopefully this winter of everyone's discontent is going to shake loose these old ideas and bring people to thinking about mobility in a very different way.
How would you urge people to change their own agendas, change the public agenda? I mean, be as specific as you can.
Well, I think I have said in the past few weeks, this is the time for transit riders and advocates and activists to join together. A lot of people who are in different groups. Some are focused on social justice, some are environmental justice, some on just plain getting people to work. People need to band together and not accept the status quo. And by that I mean it shouldn't be enough after this winter's experience to return to the quote-unquote normal MBTA. That should be not acceptable. We need to take the normal MBTA, which is at capacity in many respects and non-responsive, and turn it into a world-class transit mobility system. We can do it if we have the will to do it.
But one change, for example.
One change, the funding paradigm. We need to start shifting funds and emphasis from highways to transit. We have, for many, many decades, the funding paradigm has been disproportionate to highways over transit. We need to begin to level the playing field, number one. Number two, we need to do a much better job making transit data and information available to people. I mean, when you're in the subway, you can barely hear the announcer's call. We have the capacity to use technology to make the T much more rider-friendly, interactive. We need to do that to attract the the rider and to keep the rider.
Is there any such thing as a realistic increase in the gas tax?
No. The answer
Why
is no.
Why not? Isn't that the test, really, of whether we're getting a message?
I thought...
Whether we're changing the investment?
So the answer is, I used to think so. And 5 years ago, when I was the Secretary of Transportation, I asked for a 19-cent gas tax increase at the state level, and I got my head knocked off. It's politically poisonous. And frankly, I have come to think it's also a dinosaur, no pun intended, as a fossil fuel, right? The gas tax, because our automobiles are more fuel efficient and we're moving gradually but inexorably toward a future of hybrids, electric vehicles, and cleaner fuels, the gas tax, by definition, is becoming less and less a reliable source of revenue. I call on people to think about using technology to generate robust revenues. And the best way to do that is to charge people for what they use. We can do that through technology, whether it's all electronic tolling technology or technology that tracks not our origin and destination, but that tracks our route to know how far we've traveled. And
that's what they do in Singapore, and I do it basically on a zip car. They charge you by the mile you ride. How would you balance other ways to balance the penalty that car driving puts on all of us and the saving that the society absorbs from people using transit?
So one simple idea that I'm advocating is the creation of what I call TIDs, or Transit Improvement Districts. And that would be giving local option to communities like Cambridge or Boston to assess a carbon impact fee on non-residential parking and use that money specifically for transit, pedestrian uses, and bicycle lanes. That's one way to begin to charge the automobile driver for their use, for their carbon impact, and turn that money into a more multimodal platform.
And sort of sneak in the consideration of equity in the stakes here between cars and transit. We'll be back. Coming up, an argument from history that our transport arrangements made the core of New England what it is. Also, that this storm is changing who we are. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're learning our lessons from the storm. Some of our best talkers around Boston are transport geeks, famously like our ex-governor Michael Dukakis, also the eternal public servant Fred Salvucci of Brighton and MIT is another. Fred Salvucci would tell you that the core of New England, our transportation history, is us, starting with Paul Revere's midnight ride to Concord, 1775, but also the harbor, of course, which became the shipping port. We've got the first subway, 1897, the first complete subway system, all linked up before World War I, before the arrival of automobiles. Fred Salvucci is credited with the idea of putting the elevated central artery underground over Barney Frank's famous objection that it would be cheaper to raise the city than lower the highway. Fred Salvucci would also tell you today that the walkability that makes our town distinctive and lovable also makes it vulnerable.
We've got in Boston the government center of the state, the financial capital of New England, the international airport, the primary one in New England, the premier medical complex, maybe in the world, some of the top universities in the world, you know, the Red Sox, the Bruins, Museum of Fine Arts, all of these assets are within walking distance of each other if you could hold your breath and walk through the Sumner Tunnel. So no other city in the United States has the kind of proximity that we do. And people compare us to San Francisco, but if you think about how their regional assets are distributed around, we've got simply more concentration than anyone else. The great thing about that is I think it's one of the things that makes the city exciting and wonderful. The downside of that is all our eggs are in this basket, and if we screw it up and let it totally gridlock, we've blown the whole ball game. So the reason the MBTA was formed was to allow the Eastern Mass economy to grow and to offset some of the growing congestion from the automobile. When I was in the state government and working on some transportation initiatives there, there's a fellow that was the president of the South Shore Chamber, and he was an auto dealer. I think he had a Buick dealership, and he's a big transit advocate. And I said, hey, that's kind of interesting. And he says, yeah, it was John Volpe. You know, Volpe came up campaigning, and I'm a Republican, and Volpe's talking about the MBTA, and I said, what do I care about that? And Volpe said, you damn fool, you're not going to be able to sell another Buick if that traffic jam outside of your door gets any worse. You need the T every bit as much as the people who are going to ride on it, you know? So it was an amazing way to frame the issue for a Republican governor talking to an auto dealer. You probably remember the Jenny ads. There were an old family that made the money in whaling oil, and then they converted to petroleum, and they had these local gas stations, the Jenny service stations. But the guy was a very, you know, an old Yank, very public-spirited type, and he was convinced that, like Volpe, that the region needed a better public transit system. And he published ads in the Globe with a cartoon of Paul Revere on his horse in a three-cornered hat, surrounded by cars. And the caption was, if Paul Revere had to make his ride today, the British would have won. Here's a guy that's making his money selling gasoline, really pushing the button that we got to have a public transit system in this city. Anyway, they got some combinations of Democrats and Republicans got the MBTA statute through. I think we're now kind of confronted by the folly of about 20 years of very short-sighted thinking. And if we want Kendall to grow, if we want the Innovation District to grow, if we want the Longwood Medical Area to grow, we've got to put a lot of money into expansion of the T. And at the same time, we've got to fix the T. If job growth is blocked at Kendall or the Innovation District or Longwood, those jobs do not go to 128. They go to California or they leave the United States entirely. So to me, there's an economic imperative that goes along with an equity imperative and an environmental imperative. But to try to reach common ground, not everyone agrees on equity in the environment, but almost everyone agrees we want the economy to grow. There's no other way to grow this economy than to get serious again about public transportation as a core building block.
That was Fred Salvucci of the MIT Transit Lab. In government, he was the godfather of the Third Harbor Tunnel. John Stilgo is the eminent Harvard version of the transport talker. His beloved course for nearly 40 years covers the aesthetics and also the engineering of the built environment in America. But he has studied our Boston transit system minutely, and he's been opening his lectures this winter with a daily blast of his own adventures commuting on the Red Line from home in Norwell to Harvard Yard.
Well, my daily adventure began, I guess, on January 29, about 45 minutes before the Red Line train overshot the station at Quincy Adams, and the passengers on the platform kicked out the windows because of the smoke. The brakes stuck, made an enormous amount of smoke under one car, and the train ground its way back, and then there was a problem getting the doors open. The most important part of that incident for my students is the people who kicked the windows out at Quincy are part of the New Americans. They're young. They understand that on 9/11, the loudspeakers in the World Trade Center towers said everything's under control. And if it were not for husbands, boyfriends, and fathers calling women in those towers and telling them to disregard the official instructions, I think a great many more people would have died. Nowadays, when there is smoke and there is no announcement immediately, people act. We're looking at an organization that is failing in many places. Maybe the next general manager should come from the military. Maybe what we need is an experienced officer of the Quartermaster Corps who can figure out, plan ahead, but also understands in the flux of a great battle how to supply troops in difficult circumstances. If the T's management had been in charge of the Battle of the Bulge, we'd be speaking German. The developing issue in this country is the indebtedness of the authorities in charge of maintaining and creating infrastructure. And the way this has been handled up to now is the operating expenses and maintenance expenses have been cut beyond the bone, as we've learned. What I have noticed at Harvard, where I have taught for almost 40 years, in the last 15 years, the students from China have begun having an impact on students from the United States. The Chinese students point out that this country spends an enormous amount of money on social welfare programs. We keep funding them. Whether they work or not, we're not too clear. But China lacks them. And China has built an extraordinary infrastructure, these students claim, because they don't have the overhead of social welfare programs that the United States has. And their argument then becomes politically astoundingly incorrect, but it's extremely persuasive because they can do the math that convinces American students that they're going to have to listen to this because they have to compete with a country that's doing it. The Chinese students say that what the United States, and indeed the planet, needs is probably a one-child revolution. That way, as you control the planetary population, we see immediate impacts in reduction of greenhouse gases and so on. So instead of worrying about changing our light bulbs and making more fuel-efficient cars, we just start making a lot fewer people. This country, rich as it is, has to start making some choices. We have a worldwide military presence that costs a fortune. Secondly, we have an extraordinarily expensive social welfare program. And third, we now have an infrastructure catastrophe forced on us by climate change. We may have to give up public transportation in Boston if we can't pay for this ourselves, because Southern congressmen and Southern senators will pay for it, pay to help us, only if we improve their road systems. So every time someone talks to you about a train, think of Alliance, Texas, an inland port where the freight trains move very fast and very fluently, and everybody else drives in a car, and people are happy.
That was the very short form of Professor John Stilgo of Harvard. Among his many books, Old Fields, Photography, Glamour, and Fantasy Landscape. Ryan Chin joins us in the studio at the Futuristic Media Lab at MIT. He runs the City Science Initiative. Before we get to the future, Ryan, I want you and Jim Aloisi both to make what you will of John Stilgo's tough choices. The military empire out there, social entitlement at home, and infrastructure. Pick two.
Well, I'm all into the military part, because one of the big challenges for this is how do you operationalize and rethink the operation of the T and of...
Putting a general in charge, you mean?
Yeah, I think that there's a huge benefit to that. If you look at Singapore, which is actually a good example to think about, they do not have a pure democracy. They have a benefactor dictatorship, where they're able to make these key decisions about infrastructure. And in the case of Singapore, they've also done a lot in terms of thinking about things like congestion pricing and taxes when it comes to making the decision between transit versus the automobile.
They also don't have 800 military bases around the world.
Of course, and that's part of it. And so if you think about the kind of combination of the two, they have focused on transit, and they have actually one of the highest standards of living in the world, because you don't have to own a car to actually get around in that place. And the transit system is one of the best, primarily because they've made that decision. In fact, owning a car in Singapore is really more of a luxury item than anything else. It's not about transportation in a place like that.
Right. Huge tax on entry, huge user fees, gasoline, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's 100% import duty, and they also have a certificate of entitlement, which you have to buy through an auction that gives you the right to actually purchase an automobile.
Are they as happy, though, as the people in Alliance, Texas?
Hard to tell. Very hard to tell.
Jim Aloisi, react to John Stilgo, or Fred Salvucci, for that matter.
Well, I think they both come from the same general point of view, spoken differently, which is the sort of importance of a robust multimodal mobility platform. I think, it would be great if we had a society that was democratic but also enabled the kind of decisiveness that Singapore has. But as you know, You know, you want to put a road by the North End, and you need to have 102 community meetings, and they don't have those. We have the luxury of democracy here, and our decision-making is leavened by that. I think that can be a barrier to decisiveness, but it can also be fertile ground for empowering people to make decisions that they haven't made before. I think that the era in which we're living, this era of connectivity and technology and interactiveness, is an era where people will be more empowered to demand and insist upon decision-making that reflects their mobility preferences and paradigms, that reflects their aspirations for what their city should be. And as we look ahead, I think that will grow, and it will break some of the historic patterns of inaction. And
Jim Mahoney, what do you make of Fred Silvucci's invocation of those dear old sort of bipartisan days, John Volpe, a contractor, and the Jenny family, all supporting public education? Michael Dukakis will remind you that Abraham Lincoln built the and fought for the Transcontinental Railroad. Dwight D. Eisenhower built the interstate highway system. I mean, will we ever have that kind of political consensus
I think it's,
again?
It's not easy to think about that happening quickly on the national level, and it seems quaint to us. And yet, I would say locally, with the governor we have, with Governor Baker and Secretary Pollack, we do have there a version and a view of bipartisanship, of different ideologies that have come together on a platform of data. They're both data-driven wonks, and they come from different places on the ideological spectrum, but they're joined right now in common cause to hopefully lift up our transit system in a historic way.
Before I let Fred Silvucci go, he made you wonder whether Boston might have escaped the car almost entirely. We had a full-blown, we had a walkable city, streetcar suburbs, a complete a networked subway system before World War I. I mean, isn't that in the back of his and maybe all of our minds? What if we had a no-car city?
Well, I think that there's lots of cities actually pushing for that. The city of Hamburg in Germany has actually declared that they want to be car-free, completely car-free by 2034, less than 20 years from now. Mm. And so is the city of Helsinki, has been pushing for an on-demand transit system where you don't have to own an automobile. So both of these cities in Europe have been pushing for a car-free zone. I would say the comment on Fred is that if you think about Boston back then, and what China is experiencing now, China's building over 300 subway lines throughout the entire country.
Right.
And the U.S. is building one or one and a half. You know, there's the extension of the Green Line here. In New York City, there's also another line. But that's basically it. And part of that is because China's a new country, obviously. Back then, we were sort of building
They're
up.
Catching up in
They're
a fashion.
Catching up.
Are they overbuilding?
I don't think so. I don't think so. In fact, they have a kind of militaristic plan about why they're building the subways. In fact, the subways are connected to their high-speed rail. So, in fact, the subways are essentially a last-mile connector between cities.
I want to consider some of the not-so-obvious social effects here. The news, for example, that black people commute longer, average 22 minutes a day. I'm fascinated that there's so little comment about prisoners, state prisoners, shoveling snow for a few dimes per hour, way below the minimum wage. What do we think?
Well, you know, these are examples of how we have undervalued transit, and frankly, how we are overlooking vast numbers of people in our society. If the danger that we have is that we will move ahead on a technology platform, improve transit, and leave people behind, we cannot do that. We have to have a transit system that's responding to both to the needs of the creative class and to the needs of the people who historically depend on public transportation, poor, lower middle class, the elderly, students. The MBTA or any public transportation system has got to be an egalitarian system. That has got to be part of our future.
I'm fascinated by the late Tony Judt's fascination with trains and train stations. He thought these were the greatest things in the world, and I think I agree. He loved trains because they were a metaphor of being alone together. And he played with that notion that to be alone, you know, you're in a traffic jam, one car, one guy in a car. to be together. Together, you're in some sort of communist dictatorship. You know, everybody's having to think. But the train is a place where you can move around. You can talk to family. You can get to know a stranger. You can be entirely by yourself. And yet, in a some sort of common purpose of heading in one direction, we're all heading to Washington or Chicago. How do you think of the sort of, how do you make a metaphor of what we're looking for on that scale?
Well, I think that there is a romance behind that that is actually very powerful. We don't see evidence of that currently in the transportation networks that we have. I see a little bit of that happening in Japan these days because there's a lot of elderly folks in Japan that don't have access to an automobile, need to wait for family members to pick them up. And this new concept of an on-demand transit system, on-demand bus, where you actually call up the bus and the bus actually comes to you and it doesn't have a fixed route, allows you to essentially have very flexible kind of mobility for these seniors that actually then engage with each other on the bus, right, of course.
They're alone together.
Well, I think, you know, you can look, go to Bogota and look at what other countries are doing with bus rapid transit. Not, doesn't sound sexy, but creates an environment where people connect on a bus that appears to be a light rail vehicle, and it works.
I'm glad you mentioned Bogota. Coming up, we're wondering, Boston, Barcelona, Beijing, who is going to build the pilot project for transportation in a world of cities? And what does the idea of a Boston Olympics have to do with all of it? This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Alone together, together alone, we're looking over the snowdrifts at our trains, ourselves. Infrastructure for a future attuned to rising tides, wetter weather, inequality, reurbanization, a global competition in making cities livable now that people want to live in them again. Ryan Chin of MIT, lead the way. What do we want? Who's the model?
Well, I think one way to think about it is, you know, what do we value? Is there going to be a cultural shift away from the private personal automobile towards a multimodal, multi-choice society? That's one of the big questions. And if we answer that the right way, then this leads to other points. For example, if we're thinking about increasing gas tax. Well, maybe it should shift to a vehicle miles, as Jim has said. Well, another version of that is a PMT, which is personal miles traveled, right? We account for each person, whether they're walking, biking, sharing a car or not. We actually compute that using big data. The second thing is if we're thinking about multimodal systems, right, where you're thinking about, oh, well, we have this transit system that is working great, but we're not solving the first and last mile, which is how to get people to transit,
right?
So coming up with good systems for creating a connectivity to that is important. Of course, there's the alternative to the subway, which is the deployment of bus rapid transit systems. In fact, in this country, we're actually not very good at that. Other countries have done a great job. They cost much less, and they provide almost as good throughput. The third area is, can we start thinking about new technology, like autonomous vehicles, self-driving vehicles that are potentially part
Explain
of a shared
autonomous vehicle, somewhere between the self-driving car and the Uber.
Yeah, well, if you combine self-driving and Uber together, you have a fantastic combination. You think of a people-moving shuttle, essentially, and whenever you need a vehicle, you use your app, it comes to you, it picks you up, and perhaps you share that ride with someone else. You drop it off, and then, of course, it goes around the corner and picks other people.
In West Africa, they're called trotros.
Exactly. This is a form of paratransit. I mean, there's jitneys. These are all different terms. But I can imagine that you can create a synergistic system, a last-mile, first-mile system using shared vehicles that bring you to transit to create complementary systems where it encourages you to have intermodal shifts, and you have the right pricing models for it. The fourth area that I've been very excited about is new business models, very creative business models to think about retail, for example. How do you get more retail in combination with the subway? The thing we have now is like a Dunkin' Donuts, a little stall downstairs in the Harvard Square. I mean, that's all we have for retail from a MBTA point of view. Can we do better in that space? And there's one great example I saw recently in Korea where you can do virtual shopping in the subway, right? The subway is now painted as if it was a supermarket. You use your smartphone, you buy things on the platform, and they deliver it to your house, right? So you can think of these new
models. This is a fake food court?
It's a giant photoshopped subway platform where it literally looks like a supermarket. And then I think the fifth area is there outside influence, external factors, you know, We talk about the Olympics. Is the Olympics not just in itself an important thing for changing a place, but is it a catalyst for rethinking? And in fact, this storm is also a kind of opportunity or a gift from somewhere that says we need to really fundamentally rethink. And so can we think about the Olympics this way? I looked this up recently. The amount of federal funds devoted to the Olympics from the last three Olympics in the U.S., 1984, 1996, and 2002, there was over $2 billion devoted from federal funds. 24% of that was actually to transit.
This has been done before around the Olympics. Tokyo in 1963, I saw it myself getting ready for the 64 Olympics. China used their Olympics as a complete branding coming out party, and I'm sure transit was a huge part of it. I think we, you know, just hacking this program have been turned around on the Olympics. We're asking the world to give us a sort of a gift of another century for this whole town. Does that make sense? Does it make sense to the world? It could make terrific sense for us.
Well, nothing works better than a deadline. You know, I tell our students that all the time. There's a deadline. We have to get this project done. We have to get this prototype built.
We know deadlines.
We have to have a deadline. We have to get this car built. We have to do this. We have to do that. A deadline is nothing. There's nothing better than a deadline. And if it's artificial or if it's for real, I think you use deadlines in the right way. It motivates people and it makes us really rethink things.
Jim Alavisi, are you for the Olympics in Boston? What would you do with it?
Well, so I'm agnostic at this point. Whether we have an Olympics, whether people embrace the Olympics, in part, I think, is going to be decided by how we envision ourselves. What is our sense of place now and in the future? The answer to that question is going to inform how we embrace the Olympics. Right now, what people know is that they have a public transportation system that was in meltdown, that was not resilient. And the question is, what is the big idea? What is the big leveraging point that will enable the kind of investment and emphasis that will take that system back into a place it should be? Will that be the Olympics? Will that be our own common sense of what's right or wrong? I think the big challenge here is that our transportation is a democratic institution. I said earlier, we need to think about it as an egalitarian enterprise. Mm-hmm. The great challenge of the Olympics or the technology and where that's taking us, the kinds of things that Ryan is doing at MIT, the great challenge is to make sure that we're not leaving large numbers of people behind. Because if we don't figure out how everyone benefits from a new mobility platform, then all we're going to do is exacerbate the gap that's widening every day, the opportunity gap. So if we're going to have a future of disruption, it needs to be accessible disruption. If we're going to have a future of technology, it needs to be technology that's responding both to the people who are working in offices and the people who are cleaning those offices when those people go home at night. And I don't have an easy solution for that, but I think those are the kinds of things that challenge us to think very carefully about what we do and how we do it.
We're taking the storm as a disruption, as a gift, you were saying, Ryan, and I think it's a good way to put it. How do we preserve, I think your notion, Jim, is legibility, something that reads Boston,
yes,
that reads educational, intellectual, medical, capital, sports, madness, and all these other things that we think of as quintessential Boston, an immigrant city, political city, striving city, as you say, aspiring toward a kind of equality that we're losing, we've almost lost.
Yes. And our transportation system ought to illuminate that.
Exactly. How do you make it sort of read like Boston?
Well, I think you can do a lot of things. Ryan and I both talked briefly about bus rapid transit. If people are looking for the next new wave of investment that will have a big bang for a relatively modest buck, it's bus rapid transit. People can travel. You don't need to go to Europe. Just go to South America. Go to Curitiba. Go to Bogota. Go to Mexico City in this continent. And you will see how they have translated bus rapid transit into a very effective platform for mobility that is truly equitable. And I think Boston is ripe for transit corridors that invest in bus rapid transit, connecting Mattapan Square to Dudley, Dudley to South Station, South Station to Logan. You can have a corridor of bus rapid transit here on a very modestly priced scale that would transform how we think about investments in transportation, bring that kind of equality to the table, and prepare us for an Olympics or for a future of economic growth.
We haven't spoken enough about how we pay for it. And it seems to me somewhere we have to confront the country shortchanging the cities equation, the fact that the Electoral College, the United States Senate are all tilted against the cities, and that, as somebody said there, to get subsidies for public transit, we have to give away subsidies for bigger, more beautiful highways in Arizona, in the mountain states, this kind of thing. How do we approach that?
Well, we've both, again, Ryan and I have both talked about user fees as the first line of generating substantial net new revenue. I have also called for shifting highway dollars to transit. That's controversial. But if we're not prepared to undertake increases in the basic taxes that we pay in fares and fees, and there doesn't seem to be political will to do it, I don't believe in hitting my head against the wall too often. We need to find creative workarounds. And so some of those workarounds, I think, involve user fees. Some of those workarounds involve shifting highway dollars. Some of those workarounds involve carbon assessments. The tools are there. We need the advocates and the activists to tell legislators, it's okay, we will have your back if you support creative approaches to funding. Now, the private sector might want to also have skin in the game. You've got companies like Bridge and Cambridge that are pushing the envelope on bus mobility. But at the end of the day, the private sector is only going to invest if there's a return. And you can't have a public transportation system that operates on that basis. If you did, you wouldn't be able to serve most of the people that you need to serve.
Ryan Chin, what's the futurist's answer? We haven't even spoken about your stackable automobiles. Sounds to me like grocery pushcart that all compact together. Talk a little bit about the futurist's solution.
Well, the futurist's solution is completely disruptive, and it's already happening, right? You see the adoption of systems like Uber and Lyft that have pervasively disrupted the taxi cab industry. I think the combination of something like a peer-to-peer model like that, a kind of people delivery system, along with self-driving, which I've talked a little bit about, and the benefits of that, which is, of course, increased safety, better throughput in many cases. And, of course, humans are not very good at driving generally. One of the big problems is that we don't follow the rules. So if you combine those two things together, you have a very powerful concept that is capable of really disrupting. In fact, I hate going back to Singapore. There's been an MIT study about Singapore. There are 800,000 cars in Singapore today. It serves
that many.
There's 800,000. There's 5.4 million people, almost the size of the state here, in that very small amount of area. Those 800,000 cars service 12% of the population. It's very, very small. Most people take transit, in fact. But MIT did a study and said, well, what happens if we take those cars and shifted them into shared, meaning not owned by anyone, except you can have access to it, and autonomous? It turns out you only need 300,000 cars total. To not just move
zip cars, so to speak.
Essentially. But you need 12. You only need 300,000 cars. You can eliminate 500,000 cars from the road and service the entire population, not just the 12%. Hmm. This is an amazing number. And these are, of course, MIT rocket scientists that go through the math and think this through, which says to me that if you actually wanted to create a synergistic system between transit and this new mode of transport, you actually need even less cars than that. And as you think about that, it's a tremendous game changer if you think about it, because this car almost never needs to park. It's constantly moving people around, right? These vehicles are, and I use the word car, it actually is the wrong term. It's a vehicle that essentially caters ushers you to these highly effective, transit lines. And I think that's really the disruptive thing that could
happen. Ryan, you've spoken a lot about Singapore, semi-autocracy of the Lee family. Speak about other cities out there, other countries, east or west, that are in the game, in the lead, so to speak.
Well, other cities, Zurich is doing a great job, actually. They made investments a long time ago to look at essentially transit-oriented development as we know it today. The other city that's been doing a very interesting job is Melbourne, Australia. They've revitalized their interior of their city, just like we have with the big post Big Dig developments and all this interest in the seaport. So they've done a pretty good job as well. But no one is in the lead. In fact, you can imagine that Boston has a huge opportunity, whether it's Olympics or not, to think of our city as a living laboratory, right? We can think of ourselves as a place where we can test new things, right? And we could test them in a very temporal way because maybe they don't work out. And so it's fine. It didn't work. But if it does work, we then become the leaders because we have done it. We are the first movers. We are the ones who really test it out.
You got to give us three devices to think of. I mean, fiscal devices or emotional devices or devices to think about in Boston in the next 10 years in time to persuade the Olympic Committee?
Well, I think that the great work that the universities have done in new technology, right, big data analytics, self-driving cars, electric vehicles, all that stuff can be highlighted, right? This is all within our reach. The reason why MIT has to go over to Singapore is because we don't allow self-driving cars in the state. We have to go across the planet to do research on this. Why not we change the way we do those things and allow this great research to actually flourish here instead of moving to California or somewhere else? That's always been the case. I think that by doing that and thinking of it as a kind of technological showcase and the ability to test, and it's not just to show some fancy thing, but to be able to test and try yourself with real people that are out there. I think that's the thing that we have to really focus on.
Jim Aloisi, who's in the lead? Who ought to be in the lead? What's our chance of taking the lead?
Well, our chance of taking the lead is limited unless we embrace what Ryan is talking about is as old as the American dream. It's Franklin Roosevelt talking about bold, persistent experimentation. But we aren't doing that anymore in this country. We're not a nation or a place of risk-taking. You cannot innovate unless you're prepared to take risk. And no one will take risk unless someone's watching their back.
But who says we don't?
Who says we don't? If you look at the MBTA this winter, this non-resilient system, that's a metaphor for not taking risk, not doing the kinds of things investment-wise, bold experimentation, new ideas that we ought to be doing that is happening globally. We need to have a culture in this city to say this experience is a learning one, it's a teaching moment, and what we're going to be able to do more freely is experiment, is invest, is watch each other's back, not chronically complain about failure. You cannot innovate unless you're prepared to accept some measure of failure. But innovation and risk-taking go hand in hand.
And remind me, whose money are we risking with?
Well, it's all of our money, but it's all of our system. I mean,
are we coming out of the state budget?
I think some of it has to be shared. I think transportation funding should come primarily from transportation sources.
Ryan, last word on this gift, as you call it?
I think that we have to think about new kinds of snow melters. You know, renewable snow melters. Think about that for a bit.
I'm thinking about it. Thank you, Ryan Chin and James Aloisi. Thanks also to Fred Salvucci, John Stilgo, and Eric Howler. Thanks also to Jeff Rosenblum and Mike Zack in our Department of Public Works. There's more on our website, a look at the possible big digs of the year 2050, and sound from Paul Matisse, the installation artist who brought music to the Kendall Square Tea Station. We're going out around the bend on the Mystery Train by the band. This week was produced by commuters Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Pat Termino. George Hicks drives our train, Mary McGrath directs our traffic. I'm Christopher Leiden. Join us next time on Open Source.